Lunch with Leon.
So, welcome to episode 124 of Lunch with Leon, and thank you very much indeed for joining me again today. If you have a career in transport, it's inevitable that in this wonderful family of transport professionals, you will meet many people again in different places, in different roles, as your career progresses. In fact, my advice to all young people in transport is to keep your address book scrupulously up to date. You never know when you might need one of your friends, or they might need you. So it was a great treat recently for me to catch up with my great friend, Rose MacArthur, who is the Director of Transport, Highways, Infrastructure and Climate Change for Cheshire West and Chester Council. And before we talked about the good old days, I asked her how she first got into transport.
How does anybody get into transport completely by chance? You fall into it, don't you?
You do. That's what happened with me, completely by accident.
You completely fall into transport because I don't remember ever having had a conversation in either primary or secondary school or with any careers advisor or relating to any subject, even geography, which I did at degree level. Never once did you think, whoa, I'm going to be a transport planner, or I'm going to get into buses, or, I mean, maybe some people do wake up and think that, but yeah, completely by chance. But then once you're in it and you realise like the change that you can make and the impact you can have and like the kind of the joy that it can bring and the, you know, the outcomes, all these brilliant positive outcomes, it's quite, you know, it's quite addictive, isn't it? It's something that once you're in, I think it's hard to not have.
I think that's definitely the case. I think once you are bitten by it, you're in a family forever, aren't you?
Yeah. Oh, gosh, absolutely. Didn't you think the Rural Bus Conference was a family?
So, yes, indeed. So at the time of recording, we're just off the back of the Rural Bus Conference, which was held in your very own Chester at the racecourse, the oldest racecourse in the world.
As you said in your introductory pub quiz,
It was, and a racecourse where they race clockwise instead of anti-clockwise, which is the custom everywhere else. But there was no racing at the Rural Bus Conference. We had a full house, did we not?
And we did.
It was a great event.
It was amazing, and honestly, the feedback has just been fantastic. The positivity, and I know I was jokingly, and when I was sort of introducing myself and talking about, you know, you talk to your friends about the fact that you're going to be, you know, taking part in a Rural Bus Conference, and they look at you like you've got two heads, and you wonder where that ambition to be, like, you know, the lead singer of a rock band went. When you're hearing yourself getting excited about, you know, being in a plenary on the in a Rural Bus Conference
at a race course in Cheshire.
At a race course in Cheshire. I mean, yeah, you couldn't make that up. Maybe it was some kind of fever dream we were both in, and we're just waking up from it now, but the positivity in there, the innovation, the, you know, every exhibitor stand, the sponsors, it was full house. And, you know, I know I was reflecting with you, Leon, afterwards, wasn't I? That, you know, I was saying the sign of a good conference is standing room only at the 5 p.m. session. Everyone was so engaged. It was brilliant. It was really good.
And of course, I was there till the end because we finished up with Ruth Cadbury, who, I made the point of saying to her, because she's, as chair of the Transport Select Committee, as I said to the audience, you've never really made it into maturity in transport unless you've been before the Transport Select Committee. And in my case, Gwyneth Dunwoody.
Oh, my God.
And of course, what she did, because she was fierce, she used to kick her shoes off and waggle her ample feet in stockings beneath the table and cause you to lose your concentration momentarily. And then
try that one, Leon. Is that a good tactic? Would you recommend that next time you're somewhere uncomfortable?
Ruth Cadbury came straight on the screen and said, well, thank you very much, Leon, for comparing me with Gwyneth Dunwoody. I'll try not to use my stern face. But just to let you know, since COVID, we've had drapes over the front of the table, so you can't see anybody's feet anymore. But seriously, of course, Transport Select Committee does a fabulous job.
Yes.
It's there for all of the political parties. They've been studying the situation with Rural Bus, and no surprise anywhere, the value of public transport in rural areas is phenomenal, and the cost of providing it is equally phenomenal, and people are just everywhere. And one of the biggest I think one of the biggest things that came out of the conference was everybody unanimous that whilst rural transport has a cost attached to it, if the consequences of it not being there would be way more expensive because people would have to have their shopping delivered as opposed to being able to go and get it. They'd have to have their medical care brought to their door instead of being able to go to the doctor, and education and social services and all the social value things. And if all this stuff had to be paid for by health and education and social services and so on, it would be way more expensive than it currently costs the DfT and the money that's raised in local authorities.
It was the resounding, the piece that I took away most from that, Leon, was absolutely that. And we'd explored it in a couple of the sessions. I don't know which of the plenary, which of the sort of breakouts you went to, but I was in the one about the mini Switzerland, the kind of, and it's absolutely centered on integration, bus and rail integration. And what an amazing, project. What an amazing thing for the DfT to have got behind and, wanting to look into. And I, like you would expect me to, and like you're excellent at doing, that provocative question where you kind of, you want to kind of, you know, you're asking something a bit obtuse, you're asking something that's a little bit provocative, but you want to anyway, because you need to kind of feel what the response is. And it was in the Mini Switzerland conversation, I said, when will this wash its own face? And I think that that is literally you hit upon it brilliantly in the closing session, in the closing plenary where you were making this comment, is that transport is constantly being asked to wash its own face, cover its own costs. But you're absolutely right. There is nothing in there about, well, what's the added value? What's the social value? What's that incremental reduction in cost when you're tackling adult social isolation? Because the cost to a local authority to bring an older person into care is 100 times greater than the cost of making sure that they've got door-to-door accessible community transport, as an example. But we're never in that space because, for example, in our local authority, the community transport element is a non-statutory revenue spend. And anyone who's in local authority transport at the moment will know that anything that is non-statutory revenue spend is up for conversation, it's up for grabs, it is there. And it is, your Section 151 officer is saying, do you need this? What does it do? How can you make this pay for itself? And you have to have really, really strong politicians with that, that moral compass or that kind of persuasion that actually this is a really, really good investment to be able to safeguard and protect that non-statutory revenue. And that's where a lot of this value that was talked about, the high street retail you've just talked about, you're keeping that going because you're bringing people in to spend, you're tackling the social isolation, you're keeping people socially kind of alert. All of that stuff that rural transport brings, education, employment, social cohesion, all of that, it'll never wash its own face because you haven't got the density of movement, but it can't be seen as a cost. It's got to be seen as that value, which I know you're a great, you're a massive advocate for that, and we've spoken many times around it.
I know, and the point on community transport, which we were able to make at the conference, is that as a result of the surpluses that CT makes from its various activities, it's able to provide extremely cheaply or for free all sorts of other things that otherwise just wouldn't happen, or the local authority might have to pay for in a different way. So it is such good value, and I know, and I've heard it said so many times that you could do it with taxis more cheaply. But the truth is, CT, community transport, is proper door to door. Taxi is curb to curb. If you watch any self-respecting community transport operator, the driver knocks on your front door, locks your front door for you, helps you down the path and into the little bus, and the reverse carries your shopping in and makes sure that the place is safe before letting you go. And over and above that, much to the amazement of many colleagues, in my case on the Greater London Assembly, they love the convoluted journey with five or six other people as they go around picking people up and setting people down and so on. And it may sound strange, but for many of our users on CT, those are the only people they get to talk to all day. So they don't want to go straight to Tesco. They're very happy to go round the houses for an hour to go to Tesco because of the social interaction they have with the other people on the bus. So for those two reasons, that's why taxis don't do it, because it would just be you and the taxi driver, and he'd be sat outside waiting for you. I think it's one of those great things about CT.
Yeah, and the experience is the journey. It's not the destination, you know, as the old adage goes, you know, and that's exactly the social isolation that we're experiencing within our rural communities, but other communities as well, is so profound at the moment that anything that we can be doing to kind of tackle that in exactly the manner that you've just talked about. You know, the same goes though for not just elderly people. You know, we've been talking a lot recently about PSVAR on coaches and, you know, making sure that people with or children with sort of disabilities or other aren't feeling othered. You know, that they're part of their social network. They're getting on the bus with their friends. And that again, transport, that sort of belonging, you know, being on transport with other people experiencing the same things is such a critical part of a young person's transition into adulthood and creating independent children who become independent adults. And I think it's absolutely on both parts of the age spectrum. It's children as well as young adults and older people as well. But yeah, all of that phenomenally important.
Well, I thought it was a really good rural bus conference. It was moved under your direction to the north, because last time, of course, it was in Portsmouth. So
Did you know? I just wanted a shorter commute time, Leon. Everyone thinks I've done it, you know, to kind of showcase Chester. I just want to be able to walk to a venue for once.
it brought back many fond memories for me of Chester, because, of course, in the Queen's Hotel in Chester is where I did the deal for the purchase of Chester City Transport from the council to First Group. That was all done in the Queen's Hotel on the corner outside by the station. And of course, in those days, there were still tram tracks and cobble streets in and out of the depot, which of course have now been tarmacked over. And in fact, my good friend and listener to this podcast, Nick Vane, who you'll remember,
Yes.
Nick and I, on a foggy night in Chester, found ourselves in that little alleyway where the tram tracks were. It was like being in a sort of Dickensian movie. It was really exciting. It was like.
This? Have you written a book or anything, Leon? I might have to read up about this. Maybe I could reintroduce trolley buses or something into the
Maybe
Chester
we could.
transport scene.
So I tell you what, we should just have a bit of private reminiscing, except of course with a large
Maybe
audience.
reminiscing with a audience listening in. Love it.
I
Oh
was
God,
just thinking about
no going
our happy times doing travel demand management for the Olympics, which you did from 2009 up until 2012. And I have two stories on TDM. One is, of course, that the government didn't believe we'd done it properly. And you might remember on the morning of the opening ceremony, a particular Secretary of State ringing and saying, "We don't think you've done enough. This TDM thing is not going to work and it's going to be a disaster." And then you remember on the Monday morning when the streets were so deserted, it was like the opening credits for 28 days later. And the same Secretary of State rang up and said, "You've overdone this." Do you remember?
It's a bit of a blur, I must admit, but yeah, that does feel very real.
And you know, the TDM was a great success, and the only thing that none of the other Olympic cities that we spoke to told us was that in the first few days of week one, most of the Olympic family has gone sightseeing because there's nothing very much going on in the stadium. These are the early heats. So where were all the people Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday of week one? They'd gone to Stonehenge, Oxford, Windsor Castle. They'd left London and were doing all their sightseeing. And we really didn't get them all back into the city until the middle of week one, and that's when the heat started to warm up and some of the more famous people started to come through and so on. So that was my favorite reminisce of TDM. I think associated with it that during the course of the games it ran so well we had nothing to do, which was like a big surprise because we'd geared up for everything. And it was in that period that you and I found ourselves at 3 o'clock in the morning in a railway carriage being pulled by a steam locomotive as we tested the processes for running steam on the underground for its 150th anniversary. So, do you remember 3 o'clock in the morning in Moorgate
Was
with Lady McAlpine,
amazing.
Bill McAlpine, and then we released all the smoke from the locomotive to see if we could set the fire alarm off in the ticket hall. So those were happy days. And in fact, if anybody now, Rose, next time you're there, next time you're in Baker Street Station, which is the Hammersmith and Circle platforms, if you look up on the ceiling, beautifully restored station building, is there's a load of black soot on the roof, which is where we vented all the
I was
steam.
about to say that the memory again is, I was just remember looking up thinking, oh God, I hope no one's got to clean that off, because you know, as they were going through the station I mean, you just think back to how things were and how we are now from like a clean energy perspective. The black that was coming out of that was just like, it was awful, wasn't it? And it was sort of inches thick all across the roof. Whose idea was that? Was that you or Peter?
You are referring, of course,
one
to
or
the
other of you.
You're referring to the minister, of course.
Oh,
Lord
God, yeah,
Hendy.
Sorry. Lord Peter
Lord Hendy
Hendy.
of Richmond Hill, a guest on this podcast, of course.
Of course.
Indeed, episode 100, if you want to go back. And by the way, Rose referred to Mini Switzerland, if you want to listen to Thomas Abelman talk about Mini Switzerland, episode 115 on this very podcast.
Oh, good plugging. No. But they were crazy memories. I mean, the Olympics was an amazing time. And I talk about it a lot, not just for kind of the skills that you learned on it and, you know, the way that you could, you know, technically kind of like, you know, progress within from a career, but you were surrounded by the best of the best of the best, and you got lifted up monumentally, didn't you? Because everybody was just, you know, amazing in everything that they did, and everyone was there to kind of give their best. And I just remember being surrounded by people who were just, you know, never the like I've seen again, who were just so good at what they did. And there was so much learning took place, you know, not just about how to deliver a major event or, you know, how to get a transport system to move or how to get 9 million grumpy Londoners to do something different for the 17 days and then the Paralympics after. But it was just working in those teams. And I think the way that the ODA and LOCOG and TFL worked together as agencies, and, you know, I still quote people back, you know, the people that we were with there, I still quote a lot of the time, you know, people that I was with, and just, you know, their sense of ability to deliver and take on board, but also the level of inclusion. You know, yeah. I've never worked in an organisation that was as disability positive. I think that's the expression, isn't it? Where they really advocated for people from, you know, very different backgrounds with very different abilities to come together. And I've not experienced that since. I've not been in a workplace that was so inclusive, that was so sort of centred on such kind of like good social value and morals.
No, indeed. And I think for me, the greatest lesson was just for once, every agency was stood on the same burning platform, facing in the same direction.
Weren't they just?
And normally that's not the case, because every bit of local government, every bit of central government, plus all the other stakeholders and the funders and the sponsors, all want something slightly different to suit their particular responsibility. For the Olympics, we were all stood on the same.
I remember there was a slide deck I used to use, and so what would happen normally is Peter Hendy would stand on the stage and say, you know, the greatest games are going to come, and they're going to come to London, and this is what we're going to do, but don't worry, we know it looks, you know, tricky and difficult out there, but here's Rose and the TDM team, and she's going to tell you what to do to get through it. And I'm thinking, oh, all right, Peter, thanks for that. But then I'd stand up, and there was one particular slide I always remember, and on the bottom of it I'd put all of the people who were responsible for developing that demand management campaign. You had Highways England, as it were, there. You had the DfT, you had Transport for London, Mayor of London. You had, I can't remember, but there was about 7 or 8 different logos, badges, brands or whatever from all these different agencies who were resolutely signed up to the message that we needed to be out there. We needed to think about what we're doing, how we were traveling, you know, what we're going to do differently. And it was, you're absolutely right. I think that's a really, really interesting and very positive reflection. It was a time when everyone came together with a solid goal. This is what we're going to do, and we're going to do it really well.
Indeed. And one of the things that Peter was keen that we did, you remember we had several social events where we all came together. And Peter's rationale for that was that during games time, during preparation and then during games time, you're going to need a big address book of people whose natural answer is yes, of course.
Yeah.
And by getting us together and talking to each other in very big forums, we built that database of our friends and contacts, which was just superb. In the later stages.
And don't you find now, even now, Leon, I suppose, you know, for me, you and me, we met on the Olympics, and look at us now, you know, however many years on, sat here having a chinwag around, you know, transport. But I met people there that I wouldn't have had exposure to on any other event. And like you say, we were all at the same level because we were all responsible for delivering a brilliant games. And I've got such great friendships from that, from people I'd never normally have had that opportunity to sort of engage with. Yeah.
And many of whom have gone on to do great things as well. And the other thing we learned out of it is we learned much more about how to put on big events.
Yeah.
And, you know, in terms of safety, in terms of the mass movement of people, there's learning across various countries about how it was all done. And still to this day, people are asking London about issues to do with how they did it. And I'm reminded of it because we're fast approaching the anniversary of the terrible tragedy at the Love Parade in Germany in 2010, which was 21 people who died in a crushing incident, which you wouldn't get now. And of course, it happened because the planning was defective and people were moved into an area that was too narrow for them and various other dynamics. And as a result, the whole thing was abandoned in perpetuity. But we learnt a lot about that mass movement of people. We learnt about how the Royal Parks in London are like a sponge that can absorb a very large number of people. And it came in very useful because when it came to the Queen's funeral, Operation London Bridge, we didn't know how many people would come to London because we hadn't done it since the early 1950s. And of course, in the early 1950s, there wasn't proper television and there wasn't quite such great connectivity. So for the Queen's funeral, we didn't know whether millions of people would come or nobody would come because they could sit at home and watch it on their widescreen TV, or they could easily get to London. And we learned as a result of the Olympics that the maximum number of people that can arrive in London by all modes in a day is 1 million. A million is the rolled up capacity of the entire road and rail network. So 1 million people can come into London. And it's all right, and 1 million people can come tomorrow, provided the 1 million people who came yesterday went home.
Don't you think the other thing that came is how to tell a story? I think the other things that other major events have learned, because remember after that, I was going to Glasgow and then over to the Gold Coast, and all of this that you're talking about now was there as a chip in the heads of those people who sort of moved on from game to game. But I think one of the other brilliant things that we learned was how to tell a good story. Because it wasn't about statistics or plans or anything. It was saying, come to London, but have you considered this? And you'll need to do this. There was so much storytelling behind it. And it was, I think that was again, another sort of wonderful outcome and something I've certainly taken away. I
Well,
love
I'm
a good story.
very pleased by the way that you raised Gold Coast and not me, because after I embarrassed you in front of the whole audience by telling the whole rural bus conference about how we were inspecting all the beach venues for the Commonwealth Games in 2018 in Queensland.
Oh, we had a hard job, didn't we? Oh, it was terrible.
It was indeed. It was. But it was that transfer of knowledge, wasn't it? We
Oh,
were taking our
completely.
Olympics knowledge and reusing it in a territory that has quite different characteristics because at the end of the day, the Gold Coast is supported by a very small number of road and rail bridges.
Absolutely, completely linear because you've got the sea on one side and then the Gold Coast Highway running parallel and a rail line, but no connection between the light rail and the heavy rail then. But of course, that's changed now as a result again of having the Gold Coast there. They've managed to get the investment in the light rail to connect it up to the major, the heavy rail. Great impacts from it. But yeah, very different. But again, telling the story, major events, how does it work? I think I was working for a consultancy at the time. I was working for, I think it was Colin Buchanan, as was for those listeners who remember. So Colin Buchanan, who got bought by SKM, who were an Australian firm, and they were really, really keen that I took all of those learnings that we've got from London as sort of like a really golden thread and a level of knowledge that you wouldn't and couldn't get doing anything else. And they really wanted to kind of take that learning that we'd got from that and take it over to the Australian environment to then use within the consultancy there. And that was just before SKM got bought by Jacobs. I mean, if you stay long enough, I'm
It works
sure,
for everybody, yeah.
by accident or by default, without even trying.
So you know what the listeners are begging me to ask you now? They're begging me that since you were the princess of the largest movement of people in the London Olympics, Glasgow, Commonwealth Games,
Lot of
Commonwealth
people.
Games in Queensland, Australia, what made you come back to Cheshire?
This is a very good question, Leon. A very good question. I think, not only come back to Cheshire, but go from 20 years in the private sector, 20 years of consultancy into local authority. Oh my goodness me, nobody quite prepares you for that. So not only did I move from 20 years in London, but with a short break to go and live in Australia for 4 or 5 years. And then not only leaving London, but also leaving the private sector for local authority to come and be director of transport and highways here at Cheshire West and Chester Council. So being based in Chester, nothing could prepare you for that. And not just the physical Move. I mean, Chess is a beautiful city, and you know, it's close to Liverpool, it's close to Manchester, it's close to the North Wales coast. It's got so much going for it. It's a really, really great place to be. Brilliant quality of life. But the local authority, private sector to local authority, has been like learning Cantonese or going from an English speaking authority to somewhere in Italy. I don't know. The change is of a magnitude. The different environment that I'm in now compared to the commercial environment that I came from, it's just, I don't think I've really fully understood that. But I've got my mum's still in North Wales, in that little house I talked about, Leon, in my opening address at the Rural Bus Conference, where very, very rural area of North Wales. So she's still here and we wanted to be close to her. So my ever patient husband and little baby girl upsticked and some moved to Chester. But yeah, what a journey.
No, I can believe it. And of course, you know, I was in the private sector until I went to TfL. So it was a not a decision.
How did you find it?
I tell you what was interesting. It's funny, you know, when you're in the private sector, you've always got an eye on things like the bank balance, you know, the cash situation and so on. And all of a sudden you're in a place where somebody else does that. Quite hard to not know precisely day by day what your financial situation is.
You know what, if I was to say to you what I've found to be the most sort of, not unnerving, but certainly the bit that I haven't even yet come to terms with, is that with Mark McDonald, superb consultancy, absolutely brilliant group of people there. But they, when I was there, Profit and Loss, I knew to the penny what was where, on what project, what was overspent, what was underspent, who was charging what the resource book looked like. I had absolute kind of like no degree of separation between me and my accounts or the group accounts or the, you know, the way that our finances were working. Within local authority, I probably got 2, 3, 4 degrees of separation, where I've got a brilliant, you know, financial business partner, but he is the person who has access to the information that I will need to kind of understand what my resource budget looks like, what my pay or non-pay spend is, or where I'm up to on my capital or revenue positions. And I haven't quite yet worked out how to get that close ownership or accountability over that financial picture, which is, and we're working on it. And it's absolutely, you know, it's not, I'm not saying anything bad about where I work. It's just the difference, I think. I think that's a really interesting observation, certainly one I've got.
Indeed. And it was hard to cope with because it was one of your levers of control.
Yes.
And all of a sudden it seems to be being done by third parties. And the other reason why, look, you're having a tougher time than I did, because in my time in TfL, we had cuts, but nothing like we understand today.
Yeah.
And it's not unusual when the government does devolution, it tries to make sure that the devolved authorities are nicely funded so that it's a success, so it can claim success. And TfL was well funded in 2000, and for its first 10 to 15 years or so, but like many authorities now, the cuts are there and are very serious. And so you need greater control over the finances, don't you? Because money is so much tighter. And I think the other thing that you suffered more than I did is that now it's not unusual, is it, to lose a member of your team and to ask every other member of the team to do their job as well as their own. And a team that was 5 is then 4 and then 3, and 3 people are now doing the job of 5.
Yeah, I mean, that was the joke that I made rather lightheartedly at the beginning of the conference, Leon, where I had to give my ridiculous job title, which is, you know, Director of Transport, Homes, Infrastructure and Climate Change. And I'd started off with 2 of them, but as people leave, they're not replaced, and all of a sudden their role has to come to somebody. And you're right, yeah, the squeeze is real. And it's kind of back to that sort of opening point that you were making about transport in all of this. And I thought another really, really insightful thing that you said within the conference about this was absolutely about the fact that transport and the Treasury, you know, that sort of almost non-statutory element of it, because the value, it's cost, not value. It's the same within the local authority, these universal services like, you know, your roads, your bikes, your buses, well, roads have got obviously statutory duty, but, you know, public transport, active travel, none of that is kind of mandated like you have with adults or children spend or any of the other statutory responsibilities a local authority has. So necessarily it has to protect its spend on its statutory duty. But what that means is your universal services, the thing that bring value, transport as an enabler, all of that amazing social value, social good that comes out of it. It's known about, of course, but if you're in a non-statutory part of that spend, you will be squeezed. And you're quite right, Leon, you know, I've seen the teams that I look after have necessarily had to have been cut. And we're a really well-financially managed local authority, but we're only that because year on year on year on year, we have to make, you know, savings. We've got tens of millions of pounds of savings that we have to realise this year on top of additional cost cutting. And that's to keep ourselves out of, you know, having to have extraordinary financial support or, you know, commissioners or any of those things where you lose the autonomy as a local authority. Again, my naivety coming into local authority, I went through the first year of budget setting and cost cutting and removing, you know, revenue spend, staff pay. And I thought that was it. I thought that was me, you know, done and dusted for the next 3 years until the next. And then we had a couple of weeks, I think, where we sat down, took a breath, and then, right, Rose, so the target this year is X. You're like, what? No. I've just done that. I've just emptied my pockets. I've just gone down the back of the sofa. I have given you everything. And it's like, well, really sorry, you know, there's another 10% needed because we're not, you know, we can't keep pace with cost and demand on the local authority. So it's, I'm 4 years in now, and it will never cease to be probably the biggest, the most sort of compelling issue that I think I face is how on earth am I going to continue to make the cost savings within an area where expectation, Leon, across transport is massive. You know, potholes are seen as the barometer of whether a local authority is doing well or failing. You know, there just isn't the money to go around to kind of keep across that and keep up with the demand, essentially.
And I think we, one of the things we talked about, didn't we, on that condition of the road network is one of those cases where the Treasury has done what it usually does, which is to say, if we don't give you any money, how much worse will life be? Not much, therefore we won't give it to you. But actually, we've now had 15 years compound effect of that on the road network. And now it's really starting to show, isn't it? Because the degradation is there and it's a hot political potato now in a way that it didn't used to be.
Massive, yeah. We've got graphs I could show you that basically, you know, if we fill a pothole, then another one appears, and that's not because we're not doing a good job. We're not responsive. We've got brilliant routine reactive maintenance programs. You know, we're putting the spend in the right places. But if a road is at it, the end of its serviceable life, and you don't have the money to completely, you know, rebuild it, you just have to keep patching, and it's not helping. But it's hard. It's like whack-a-mole, you know, now.
And of course, made worse by the fact that people want more energy, so the road has to be dug up. They want more telecoms, so the road has to be dug up. Yeah. There is this now, this climate thing where these very hot sessions that we're having causes the drains to silt up and so on, followed by torrential rainfall where now the rain doesn't drain away properly, so the subsoil is being washed away. So by the time you've added the statutory undertakers and digging it all up, then you've added on top of that the subsoil being washed away. Add on top of that the odd burst water main or two as a result of not enough investment in the water industry.
Yeah.
And if you really want to stretch a point, inferior oil, since we don't have Russian oil anymore, producing possibly not quite such good tarmac, it's not surprising that roads are in such a terrible state.
Yeah, and once you've damaged the integrity of the road, like you say, with the utility, you know, that's it then. And as much as we kind of like want right first time repairs, and we've got really, really good sort of inspection officers who go around and say, you know, that's not good enough redo, you've damaged the integrity of it. Climate adaptation actually sits within my highways department, so flooding and trees, because you've talked about flooding, but from a tree perspective as well, they come under often as a highway asset because they're close and the proximity to sort of fast roads, you need to be really careful. And then the wind, the drought, and then the very, very wet seasons, all of that is undermining the integrity of pretty much all of our asset bases. I've got bridges as well, Leon, under me. So like the scour assessments, you know, the erosion, the high-risk assets, the majority of them sit within my area. And I've got an amazing head of highways called Jane Black. She's supreme, absolutely wonderful individual. And she, you know, she says I sleepless night. She really does keep her awake at night, just the integrity of those assets in light of the changing climate and the historic underinvestment in those assets. And I will say, you know, it's really important to kind of say that the DfT have brought out a structures fund. You know, they're investing more. They've given us 3 years revenue, 4 year capital kind of spend because we're not an MCA at the moment. So, you know, they are really trying to get ahead of the curve. I absolutely want to kind of go on record to say I'm not moaning or complaining. Please give me more money. Don't bite the hand that feeds you, Leon.
No, indeed. So, Rose, there we are. We've been all the way from the Olympic Games via Australia to potholes in Cheshire.
End on a high, Laura. And Leon, end on a high.
End on a high, that's for sure. But we will end on a high because we are still basking in the glory of a very successful rural bus conference, which we can do. By the time this is broadcast, it will have been 3 or 4 weeks ago. But it was tremendous. We'll be back with our quality bus conference in Nottingham in November. So there's still more to go for. And if you go to the Bus Centre of Excellence website, you'll find all the details about that. I've been talking to Rose MacArthur, who is the Director, Transport, Highways, Infrastructure and Climate Change at Cheshire West and Chester Council, an old friend of mine, as you know. Lunch with Leon is presented in conjunction with Passenger Transport Magazine. Please go across to Passenger Transport for all your latest public transport information. And as for this, we'll be back with another episode soon. But in the meantime, Rose, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Leon. Lovely to talk to you.
Sunshine on the roundabout turning. Ooh, ah, quick feet, and the town keeps learning. Rose MacArthur maps our streets, plans new signs, Director for Transport, Highways, Infrastructure and Climate Change. She aligns at Cheshire West and Chester Council. She stands tall, stitching paths and pavements, answering the call. From sketch to street, from plan to home, from morning tram to every path we roam. Rose MacArthur leading the way. Ah, Rose MacArthur leading the way. Laying down the pathways for a brighter day. Laying down the pathways for a brighter day. A transport planner with a clever mind helped shape the flow at London 2012, a milestone in time. 5 years in Australia under wide blue skies brought back fresh ideas and bolder, kinder ties. Quick steps, bold maps, a steady hand, turning big ideas into journeys across the land. Rose MacArthur leading the way. Ah, Rose MacArthur leading the way. Laying down the pathways for a brighter day. Rose listens when she charts. Hands on the map, feet on the ground. Voices of the town and the plan she found. Clever, bright, beautiful, steady and free. Kind and bold, shaping what we see. Rose MacArthur leading the way. Ah, Rose MacArthur leading the way. Laying down the pathways for a brighter day. Laying down the pathways for a brighter day. Sunshine, 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 sunshine on the roundabout turn.